Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and chair of this program. Our speaker today, Dr. Pelletier, is a clinical professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Department of Family and Community Medicine, and Department of Psychiatry at the University of California School of Medicine in San Francisco. At UCSF Med, he is the director of the Corporate Health Improvement Program, a collaborative research program between CHIP and 15 Fortune 500 corporations. He is also a medical and business consultant to the United States Department of Health and Human Services, the World Health Organization, the NBGH, the Federation of State Medical Boards, etc., and major corporations. He is the author of many books, including Change Your Genes, Change Your Life, which is available outside for signing after the program. Dr. Pelletier.
Thank you. That was a great introduction. Good to see all of you here. I didn't know if there'd be five people here or 10, or I had no idea how many people would turn out, but it's nice to see so many of you here. So I'll just launch in and for about 45 minutes try to cover a lot of information. And then and leaving the last 15 minutes or so for hopefully, you know, some useful discussion and questions. Hopefully this will trigger some thoughts that would be of interest to you. So let's launch off into this. So this is just, this is not necessary here, but it's for CME purposes. So the topic is in the clinical sense, epigenetics. So what is it? Basically, you know, there are two pathways that genetic research has taken. One is the disease prediction model. It's the 23andMe model. I think we're all familiar with that, right? So it's the, you've got a 40% likelihood of whatever it is, and then you wring your hands and you think, oh my God, I'm doomed. Okay, that's not what I'm talking about. In fact, I really object to that kind of method. It's statistical. It's not individual. Has nothing to do with you. And most importantly, it doesn't tell you anything about the other 60% of the people that have the same genetic pattern that do not develop the disease. Those are the people I'm interested in. So what we're looking at, my approach, our approach at UCSF in our research, is on the healthy biomarkers. So what are biomarkers? It's think of cholesterol. If this was 10 years ago and I asked you for your cholesterol level, a lot of people would not know. My guess is now, tonight, everyone knows your cholesterol level. That is a biomarker. Okay, it's a number associated with a major biological variable. And we're going to look at that. And that's what I think is the best part of epigenetics, which is how do we maintain optimal biomarkers on multiple parameters so the result is an extended life of high quality and high quantity. Okay, that's the objective. So the genomics is the study of the gene itself, the entire gene, and things are getting so sophisticated now that mapping your entire human gene will be possible in a year or two at less than $1,000. You'll have the whole library. It's your personal Library of Congress. You'll have every known variable from your genetic code. How to interpret it, that's a different matter, but you'll have it. So epigenetics then is what happens to that genetic information. How is that expressed in your life? And what is significant about this, my book title, Change Your Genes, is actually a gotcha title. We don't change our genes. They never change. They can be damaged by radiation. They can be damaged by petrochemicals. I think the Monsanto glyphosate issue is very significant. Glyphosates and Roundup is a known carcinogen, according to the World Health Organization. Our EPA, in all of its wisdom, has declined to weigh in on that issue. But to me, the alarming part about Roundup is that there was a study 2 months ago looking at plankton in the Arctic Ocean, the Antarctic Ocean. And what they found is that glyphosates are in the cell of every single plankton organism in Antarctica. So it's pervasive. It literally, we have poisoned the planet with a known carcinogen. So epigenesis is what triggers the gene, what makes it manifest or what makes it suppressed, and that's epigenetics. Metabolomics are the results of that interaction. So when the stress, the diet, the whatever it is interacts with the gene, you have a byproduct or metabolomic, and that tells us a great deal about what's occurring. And that shows up in the last item, which is the microbiome. So the microbiome is the intestinal tract. It's everything from the mouth to the anus. And we'll see later on that this is a hugely important unknown part of this puzzle. The microbiome has tens of trillions of cells, 40 to 50 trillion cells. It's 10 to 20 times more than all the cells in the human body. Now that's staggering, and think about the consequences of that. There's a whole area of study called the brain-gut connection, because the receptor sites that are most common in the intestinal tract are most common in the human brain. So we have an intimate connection, an interaction between the gut and the brain. So this is ENCODE. It was a research project between 32 research institutes, concluded in 2012. And it, the most significant thing, I think, is that is the map of the 97% junk or hidden DNA. 97% of the DNA, we do not know what it does. That's staggering if you think about it. It's called the dark genome. It's like if you were exploring the continent of North America, you landed in Massachusetts and you thought, got it. I understand everything about this continent. So there's yet to be an immense amount of information discovered. So this is, when all is said and done, what we need to know about genetics, right? So that's it in a nutshell. I love cartoons, so get ready. There's a whole bunch of them in here. I always think it's like the best way to convey information. I've had people come up to me years later and go, that lecture was great. And I go, you really liked it? Yeah, the cartoons were. So you won't remember the lecture, but you'll remember the cartoons. Now, this shows you how long ago the effect of the environment had a direct an irrevocable and significant impact on our genes. Between 7,000 to 5,000 years ago, there were two systems of clans that were in Europe. One was a matrilineal clan, very equal in task and responsibilities, in what they did, how they related to each other, not very high in warfare, not engaged in conquest, as a matrilineal, of course. The patrilineal, quite the opposite. It was male-dominated, very aggressive, a great deal of warfare, and a lot of killing between these clans. What happened was it was so extensive that the gene pool of the patrilineal clan actually was diminished. So the number of genetic components available for expression was diminished and has carried forward to the present time. On the other hand, the matrilineal culture, the genes remained robust, diverse, and that remains to the present time. And we see this in showing up in different cultures, and we see it showing up in the fact that we, now, today, have 5 to 7% of our DNA is actually Neanderthal. There's some consequences of that. So it's like something's just not right. Our air is clean. Our water is pure. We all get plenty of exercise. Everything we eat is organic and free range, and yet nobody lives past 30. Okay, so it's the Paleolithic paradox or something. That's a good diet book. I'll have to. So this is the line of research we're working on. We're working on what we call a tripartite assay. And the point is that whenever I go to conferences, I hear about, you know, the paleo diet, the keto diet, the high fat, the low fat, the celery fasting diet, which is the fad now. I mean, that's everywhere, right? The celery fast. I'm sure you've heard of it. And you know, none of it makes sense. There's no diet that fits everyone. And so this is a way to say we have to know who we are before we can determine what is the right diet? What's the right stress management technique? What's the environmental exposure doing to us? So we need a biochemical profile. And this is our attempt to create this definitive, individualized biochemical profile. So the first component is then genetic, which is like the blueprint of a house. So it says, here's kind of the ideal schematic for a house you want to build. The second is your blood, so blood chemistry. It says you take the structure, and then how is it manifesting in your blood that feeds your organs, your brain, the development of your entire mind and body. And the last is then the biome, or the microbiome, the intestinal tract. So when everything is said and done, you have the ideal pattern, the effect on your blood, the effect on the body, and you see what is the result. And you couple that with a genetic counselor who helps you understand the output from this. So this is our goal, this tripartite assay. And there are companies that are doing most, if not all, of this. And I'll give you their names later as we go forward if you want to try this for yourself. So bad news, it's curiosity. Okay. So there are some things that are what they call monogenic. I'm glad you like these. I love them. Or monogenic, or what are called fully penetrant. Those diseases are usually neurological in nature and show up within the first year. So after the first year of life, and after that genetic predisposition to neurological disorders, everything from that point on is dependent upon what we do, how we interact with our genes, and how we manifest or not predispositions, plus or minus, that we have. Now, how does this happen? There is a sheath around every gene. It's like a glove on a hand. And the glove, they're called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. Like everything in genetics, it's got a long name, and it's called SNPs for short. And the third bullet point is the most significant. These are like rheostats. They coat the gene, and you turn them up or you turn them down. So it's like if you go into a room with a rheostat, you can make the light brighter or you can make it more dim. And that's how the stress, diet, environment, pharmaceuticals interact with the gene. They turn the rheostats up or they turn them down through this mechanism of the SNP. And you see that SNPs are influenced by diet, nutrition, stress and meditation, radiation. By the way, that is one of the ways the genes can be damaged. I think I mentioned earlier the radiation, petrochemical exposure, and environmental toxins like endocrine disruptors in the environment that are basically from eating meat. You develop a large intake of endocrine substances. Physical and psychosocial environment, medications, endocrine disruptors, as I just mentioned, and a sense of purpose. It's interesting how there's some research looking at very subtle influences of purpose, of mind-body interaction in epigenetics. Now, this study is a classic, and this was really one of the first studies that said genetics is not our destiny. It does not determine who and what we are. This was done by Bert Vogelstein at Johns Hopkins University, and he completed a longitudinal study. I think it was 6,000 or 7,000 pairs of twins, and he focused on 24 diseases over 15 years. So this is a long, sophisticated study. And what he asked is that if one identical twin had a disease, what was the likelihood the other twin would have the same disease? Now, if they're identical twins, you'd think it's 100%. One has cancer, the other will have cancer. Turned out to be totally wrong. What he found is that the risk for Parkinson's disease, if one twin had Parkinson's, the other twin had a 5% likelihood of Parkinson's, virtually nothing. Heart disease, 50-50, so flip a coin. So it's pretty useless prediction. And most cancers were less than 50%. And furthermore, not only were the predictions not very good for twin to twin, it was only predict one disease. So if you had heart disease in one twin and you predicted heart disease in the other, you might miss cancer, irritable bowel syndrome, arthritis, every other condition that the twin was subject to. So you could only predict one disease, and that was highly inaccurate. So this was one of those wake-up calls that something different was going on than we ever expected for genetics. So this one. So you don't look anything like the long-haired skinny kid I married 25 years ago. I need a DNA sample to make sure it's still you. So his DNA has not changed. It is him, but you can see what 25 years has done to him and all of us, I guess. All right. So what do we test when we're doing this assay? We look at genetics and it's whole genome testing. We look at the blood. We look at 100 biomarkers. Now, if you go, you have your annual physical, you'll get 15 to 20 blood markers, right? If it's out of range, above or below, you'll pay attention to it. If not, it's like, forget it. It's like everything's normal, fine, and that's the end of the commentary. Problem is, there's hordes of information in that blood sample and in the subfraction. So we look at literally hundreds of components of the blood in making these predictions and assays. And finally, the microbiome. Now, the microbiome is today kind of like the hieroglyphics before the Rosetta Stone. You know, there are 40 trillion cells. There are 300 colonies of bacteria with trillions of cells in each colony, all in interaction with each other. Can you imagine trying to figure out what that's all about? But it's being done. There are a number of NYU, Mayo Clinic that are making some real headway in doing this. So the biomarkers that we've selected are ones that are stable from time one to time two. So one of the things we did is we drew our own blood, froze some, sent it to a lab, and then 3 months later sent our second frozen sample to the same lab and wanted to see, did the results agree? No, they didn't. Very often we'd get back a report that looked like a totally different person. So lab error is very frequent. So you have to make sure you're going to the same lab, a good lab, and that's why the really good genomic testing companies use one lab. Like we use Mayo Clinic or we use NYU or Scripps or, you know, a single excellent lab. Changes can be made in the expression of these genes by lifestyle choices. So if I told you here's gene X and it means whatever, if you couldn't do anything about it, I think I've done you a disservice. What's that done for you? It just makes you alarmed or agitated or, you know, whatever. Changes can be detected in a maximum time frame of 10 to 12 weeks. So if you decided today that you had a gene that was being expressed in a way you didn't like, if you initiated changes, the maximum time it would take to bring that into an optimal zone is about 10 to 12 weeks. Most of these changes take place literally in minutes and days. This is a rapidly, constant interaction. I think the greatest misconception we have about genetics is that it's a like the hard drive on a computer, a set of invariant rules that govern everything of how the system operates. It's not the case. It's more like an interactive software. So it's an AI system where we're constantly in interaction with our own genes. Literally, whatever you just had for dinner is already interacting with your genes. Right now. Think of that, right? And they're commercially available. So this is something that's accessible. Now, this is one of the companies we're working with. It's called Day 2. And again, this is one of those sidebars. If you want to participate in this, you can do this. By the way, I don't have any financial interest, compensation, whatever, bribery from this company. It's just one that I find is one of the very good ones. So if you go to day2.com, they have a really excellent dietary assay, especially if you're concerned about weight loss, pre-diabetes, diabetic conditions, that particular risk factor for heart disease. If you enter that system, I've worked with them long enough, they've actually given me a code that will give you a 30% discount. Okay? And it's just Dr. Pelletier 30, Dr. Pelletier 30. Go into Day 2, when you place your order, put Dr. Pelletier 30, it'll generate a 30% discount. And I'll come back to that. Anyway, this particular one was founded 10 years ago at the Weizmann Institute in Israel, which is one of the world's great nutritional research centers. They've matched over 20,000 foods. And what they'll do is they take a sample. It's actually a stool sample, but it's like 2 grams, a very minute amount. They will type that to 20,000 foods and give you a printout. It'll say, for instance, don't eat almonds. You're not genetically programmed to digest almonds. Eat walnuts because they're great for your metabolism. Literally, it will get down to that degree of precise. And I've done all of these tests myself. And I was really surprised at some things in my own diet that I've paid a lot of attention to, that this showed up and I've made subsequent changes. So this is an extremely good, and it's on the bottom, day2.com is their address. Now, this is a couple of examples of what I mean by how different our epigenetic expression is. So if you look on the left-hand one, you'll see four sine waves, right? So you've got the light green one, then you've got a kind of a light blue one that's very soft. That is the same food ingested by four different people. Same food. Four totally different glycemic index responses. Now, the significance of glycemic index is that's a great indication of stress on the body. So if you're constantly eating something that's creating a glycemic spike, your pancreas has to react to that to bring it into normal. Then you do it again and again and again. And pretty soon you develop pancreatic exhaustion. You develop preconditions for pre-diabetic. And then finally, ultimately, type 2 diabetes. So this is a great measure of overall health and something that we can modify. So this is, again, same food, four different people, four remarkably different responses. Okay, and the right side, okay, right now I'll ask you, what's better for your blood sugar, a banana or an Oreo cookie? Anyone? A banana, right? How many say banana? Okay, all right. Well, this is one of those surprises. The upper graph shows the yellow line is a banana. That's producing for this individual a higher spike than the blue line, which is an Oreo cookie. Right? I kind of like this one. The one on the bottom is the more predictable response, where you get the blue graph, which is the Oreo cookie, spiking your blood, and the banana produces a relatively flat response. The point, and maybe 40% of the people have this kind of contradictory response. You'll take something that you think at face value, like white rice versus brown rice. Okay, how many think brown rice is better for you than white rice? Okay, gotcha. Again, for any number, so 30 or 40% of the people, brown rice actually produces a greater spike in glycemic index than white rice. Now, we can't possibly know these things. These are not, it's not intuitive. You really can't feel it. It's something that requires this kind of genetic assays, and that's what we're working on. So you get absolutely clear information. So you know if you're eating a banana versus a cookie, you're doing it for a good reason. Like I said, I like that one on the upper part. So the protocol looks basically, we're looking at the microbiome. There's a microbiome sample, blood tests, hundreds of markers, questionnaires, basically, anthropometric measures, so height, weight, the usual blood pressure, etc., and food diary. It's fed into an algorithm, and what you get is, for instance, here it says potatoes are good, strawberries are bad. Strawberries very often will spike a glycemic index. Then you have wheat is bad because if you have a gluten allergy, that's going to produce a lot of difficulties in your intestinal tract. And the last one is cruciferous vegetables. In this case, I guess this broccoli is good. So that's the kind of very specific information you get out of this day two assay. Okay, so this is it. I got one of those DNA tests. Turns out I'm 85% water, 8% dirt, and 7% dog pee. I mean, right? You gotta love this stuff. These are not easy to find. I tell you, I have to do more research looking for cartoons than I do, statistics. Okay, so this I'm not going to spend time on this because we could literally spend days on this one. This is basically biochemistry 101 in one graph. And in essence, we have seven major biochemical pathways in the body. These seven biochemical pathways are governed by a multiplicity of genes that we are continually influencing. So take the second one, inflammation. Today, it's a common misconception that inflammation is bad, that it causes heart disease, arthritis, inflammatory bowel disease. And that's true in extreme. But if you had too little inflammation, you'd be susceptible to every cold, flu, virus, autoimmune disease that there was on the planet. So what we want is an optimal range range of inflammation. And you can determine this through these assays. And the same with every one of these seven major pathways. You want to optimize within a range the optimal level for health and optimal level for longevity. That's in, I keep saying that word longevity. We'll get to some very fascinating research. I mean, we might think we can or cannot change heart disease risk. We can, but we may not believe it. But we think, okay, our life expectancy is set. Not at all. Highly modifiable. So this is eat less, exercise more, and invent a time machine so you can go back in time and choose parents with better genetics. If we had our ways, we probably would do that. So this is, I'm going to skip this. This is simply a detailed printout. Again, I'm not going to spend much time. This is a real patient, this person is not the real patient, but it's real data from a real patient. If you look at the first set of dots on the left, you'll see they're in the red zone. So this was a person, 40-year-old male, with high risk for heart disease. I mean, this is in our cardiology clinic. He's heading for a heart attack, unequivocally. Every single one of his biomarkers are elevated for cardiovascular risk. Over the course of four genetic assays in which he's given specific information about how to modify that particular biomarker, you can see over on the right-hand side, he's brought every single one down into green, with the exception of one, and that's a whole other matter. But you see, he's brought them into a green zone. So he's taken his high cardiovascular risk and brought it into a low range of optimal health inside of a year, just by getting information, making modifiable changes in his lifestyle. This is astounding. Give me a skip. So this is, I demand a DNA test. So clearly, hopefully you're now intrigued and you're going to demand a DNA test. So this is the microbiome. As I said, it's the intestinal tract. And this simply illustrates that it changes over time. So from infancy to advanced age, your biome will change. So if you tested your biome at 20, 40, 50, 60, it will be different. So about every decade, it's a good idea to basically check in with this biome, because it's aging, it's changing. The cells are the cell composition is changing. What you can consume and digest will change over time. And again, these are tens of trillions of cells. It's a staggering number in this intestinal tract. So your weight problem is partly genetic and partly Boston cream pie. So it's how does the gut relate to our diet and vice versa is really the issue the microbiome is trying to solve. Now, given the fact that we've now tested thousands of people with these genetic assays, there are certain dietary recommendations that I give to you now, there are eight of them, that are generally good recommendations that have come out of, as we look at all the diet prescriptions that arise for these people, what looks to be a reasonable set. So one is reducing all forms of bad fats, and includes saturated fats, which is beef, butter, and cheese. And by the way, I am a pescatarian, I fish eating. I'm not anti-beef. It's that raised beef and slaughtered beef is loaded with antibiotics, it's loaded with fat, and it's loaded with chemicals and hormones that you just don't want in your body. If it's free range, if it's slaughtered humanely, et cetera, there's no problem with eating beef, but have it be something that is a high quality. Trans fats are evil, and those are found in all processed foods. There was just a study that came out today. I was reading it before the talk began. They did a study in France of 105,000 individuals, and they looked at their consumption of highly processed foods, ranging from the highest quartile, highest degree of processed foods in their diet, to the lowest quartile, which was the least amount of processed foods. And they found the incidence of heart disease, cancer, arthritis, all the major chronic diseases were 62% higher in the processed food consumption individuals. 62% from just processed versus more organic-based diets. increased consumption of monounsaturated fats, nuts, avocados, extra virgin olive oil. Decrease your intake of harmful carbohydrates. So an example of that is white flour. White flour in the first stage of digestion becomes a sugar. So you might as well eat spoons of sugar. Increase your consumption of high-quality carbs, whole grains. Those are the good things. Consume more cruciferous vegetables. So those are all the broccoli, cauliflower. And it gets its name, by the way, cruciferous. If you cut through the stem of broccoli, you'll see that there's an X, there's like an X shape in the stalk. That's where it gets its name. So any of those vegetables that have a cross in the stalk are beneficial. Increase the amount of folic acid. This is really critical. Increase B12, which we're frequently B12 deficient, and more B6 also from whole grain products, vegetables, nuts, and organic meats, and free swimming, deep ocean, cold water fish. So the recommendations we try to make like this are don't take these if you're nursing, pregnant, or about to become pregnant. Now, they're not going to do him a whole lot of good. Right. So these are useless recommendations. And that's what I meant by 23andMe. It makes a lot of useless recommendations. And that's why I object to these kinds of pointing the finger, genetic, biological, reductionistic approaches. They just are misleading. You want information you can use. Now, this is, what's the impact? I mean, someone says, well, yeah, you know, I'll change my diet a little bit. I'll do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. What's the impact? I mean, what's the big deal? This is a classic study called the EPIC study that was published in 2009. And they looked at 23,000 individuals over 8 years. And they looked at smoking, exercising, diet of the kind we just described, and maintaining a healthy weight. What they found is that there was a 93% reduction in diabetes, 81% reduction in heart attacks, MIs, 50% fewer strokes, and 36% fewer cancers. That's staggering. If you had a drug that did this, you'd have the Nobel Prize. Now, these are just these simple dietary recommendations. Now, to me, what's so interesting about epigenetics is we can see it. You can measure it. You know for a certainty that something is influencing you, not just guessing if I change my diet, I'm going to feel better in 6 months or a year. Okay, so this is now shifting gears from diet to physical activity. This is a study that actually was published after my book. So there was Dr. Fergus Shanahan at the University of College Cork in Ireland looked at the microbiome from 40 professional rugby players versus 46 generally leisurely but active males. And what he found was that there were 93 biomarkers that changed presumably in a healthy direction. And what he found was a higher level of probiotic bacterium, i.e. their digestion would be improved for everything that they were consuming. And there were more short chain fatty acids, again, indicative of a positive diet. And so this is, again, comparing healthy active to professionally active individuals. I blame my weight on my bad genetics. I was born with a mouth and a stomach. So, guilty. So this is now shifting gears to the area of healthy aging, life expectancy. And most of us assume that genetics clearly govern how long we will live. It's a common misconception. And where this is most critical is that in the human body, there's an X-shaped chromosome, and the length of the arm of that chromosome and the tip of it is like a shoelace tip. So if it's long and the tip is intact, it will replicate accurately over time. You will live a long life expectancy. And if you think about it, for 30 years, there's been something known as the Hayflick limit. Leonard Hayflick was a biochemist who basically said, if you take a culture of cells under perfect conditions and allow them to replicate over time, the equivalent in human life expectancy will be about 120 to 125 years. That's astounding. So if you think about it, why are we only living to be 70 or 80? if our programming ideally says we should be living to 120, 125. And Jean Calumet, who's the woman who lived to be the longest documented age, was 123. She died in Paris about 5 years ago. In a little side note on that one, you know, in Paris, apartments are such a premium, kind of like San Francisco, that people vie for these. And you can actually sell your property to someone that wants to buy it before you leave. And she sold her property three times and outlived three buyers. So at 123, she died in her property, still owning it after outliving three buyers. Anyway, so what we find is that the telomere was discovered by Elizabeth Blackburn, who's a faculty member at UCSF, and she was awarded the Nobel Prize about 5 years ago. And the telomere is simply, if you look on the right, you see that that is an intact replication, and that's going to basically generate out to 120, 125 years. I'm going to skip this. And this is a study that is completed, that the reference is on the bottom, and Elizabeth Blackburn is a second author. But it was a lifestyle intervention of the kind that we're describing that consisted of diet, like we described, exercise, like we've been looking at, stress management, really critical, and we'll look at a little bit of detail, and increased social support, so people with people. We did a program for the state of California probably 20 years ago called Friends Can Be Good Medicine, based on the fact that people who have close relatives, close relations, have one-tenth the risk of a heart attack than those who do not. So our relationship to other people, families, friends, are really critical to our life expectancy. I'll skip this one. This is simply to indicate that there are pharmaceutical interventions. So telomerase is an enzyme that actually produces more intact telomeres. And they did this with mice and injected mice that were raised to have cancer and die relatively early. And when they injected them with telomerase, they found the brain, spleen, and reproductive organs were all rejuvenated. The brain is considered to be an organ that does not regenerate neurons. It does. And there's some research now with humans that it also happens in humans. The increased a sense of smell has returned. And the decrement, the impairment of sense of smell, is a very good marker for Alzheimer's. So because the olfactory nerves are embedded deep in the brain, and they basically are like a canary in the coal mine. It gives us an indication of what is happening in the deep brain in a non-surgical manner. And none of the mice developed cancer. It's astounding for one pharmaceutical. So these are now the same way we looked at diet, to look at what have we gleaned from our patients about longevity. And these are 12 factors that are common to the people that we have seen who have seemed to have longer life expectancies consistent with what we've been looking at. And this is consistent with the blue zones. How many of you know that concept, blue zones? All right, there are communities around the world where people live into their 90s and hundreds. And there are about five of them. Dan Buettner has, with National Geographic, has conducted and written a very good book on that. So what do they look like? They all basically have a Mediterranean diet. They eat fish, but little red meat or poultry. Not philosophical about red meat. It's very expensive to raise animals for slaughter. Just is. So they can't afford to be so unhealthy. Smoking. They do smoke. And you'll very often see photographs of videos and you see them smoking. You think, that's weird. But they roll their own. They're like little cigars. They use the tobacco leaf. It's not processed. There's no chemicals. There's no filter that supposedly improves or reduces the cancer risk, but it also increases it because of the chemicals from the filters. But you see them actually puffing like little cigars. So they do smoke. Physical activity is daily farming or fishing. They don't have gyms. You ask them about aerobics and they go, what? You know, they have strong psychosocial bonds. They all work together. They help each other. They take care of each other when they're well. They take care of each other when they're sick. They join in the harvest, etc. Old age is respected. There's no such thing as turning 65 and being relegated. That's a myth. And why 65 was created, that's a whole other matter. But they are seen as the head of the household. They make the critical decisions about food, about finance, about marriage, the works. We did a research project in Poland, and it was a smoking cessation project that we knew worked. It was beautiful. And we went and it totally failed. And we said, what's going on? And we asked our colleagues in Warsaw, what is going on? They said, well, did you talk to the grandmothers? We said, what? Why would we talk to the grandmothers? They said, because they make all the decisions. So if you're only talking to the parents and you convince them not to smoke, but the grandmother isn't involved, it's not going to happen. So we got the grandmothers involved in the smoking cessation program, took off like a rocket. Sexually active. So there's touching, hugging, intercourse, well into their 80s and 90s. Sidebar. It's interesting, I'll tell you, to be propositioned by a woman in her 90s. You know, right, for the women to be for the men, but interesting experience. anyway, there's no fear of death in these cultures. They live, when they lived in their 90s and even 100, when they die, it's very quick. 2 or 3 days, they're gone. Most often, they know it and they'll say it. They'll say, I'm saying goodnight to you for the last time because I'm not going to be here in the morning. Or they'll say, by the end of the weekend, I will have left you. They know when they're going to die. And it's very quick and very clear. So that long, lingering morbidity, decades, months of disability is virtually non-existent. Jim Fries, who's a professor of medicine at Stanford, has called it the squaring of the curve. The longer we live, the quicker we'll be the time we will die. Alcohol consumption. They drink a lot more than we would ever consider moderate. I can tell you that for a certainty. But they drink it with food and in company. So it's usually beer or wine. It's not hard alcohol. They don't binge drink. They don't do any of the silly things that we do with alcohol consumption in our post-industrial nations. So it is a good thing. They have appropriate primary care. They have good basic medical care. They have very good doctors that they can go to for general medical services. And these services include what we call alternative therapies. So things like homeopathy, herbal medicine, chiropractic, Ayurvedic are all part of what they have as a normal part of their armamentarium. So what we call alternative, they simply call mainstream care. I remember working with IBM in Southeast Asia, in Thailand, and they had Ayurvedic medicine covered as part of their medical plan. And I said, you're kidding. And they said, well, you know, 60% of our population comes from India. If we didn't have Ayurveda, we would not be delivering a full benefit plan. So I thought, okay, that's a real eye-opener. They clearly have genetic influences. However, decades and centuries of, they have a genetic push. But even if you have long-lived parents, it's not a guarantee you're going to live a long time. If you do all of these other things wrong, you can shorten your life expectancy. You can change and disrupt the telomere, just as you can extend it. And lastly, there is a wisdom and introspection. There's really a profound sense of wisdom about life, about themselves, about what's important for them. And it's very clear when you're around them.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
Okay, last few PowerPoints. Meditation and epigenetics. Clearly, stress has a powerful negative impact on genetic expression. If you think about what stress does in the human body, it changes the biochemistry. And the biochemical change is essentially catabolic. So it's energy mobilization, and your body is literally incinerating fat, incinerating your biochemistry to produce a response to save your life. If you didn't, we'd be in real trouble. The problem is when that goes on for too long a period of time, it becomes a problem. So elevated blood pressure temporarily becomes hypertension. Elevated blood sugar levels becomes diabetes. Elevated heart rate becomes tachycardia or arrhythmia. So you have all of these conditions that arise from hyperarousal. Meditation is just the opposite. It basically breaks that cycle into manageable short-term intervals. And so this one study was at Harvard. They looked at 22,000 genes, don't know how many people, 26. So 26 practitioners over a period of time of 12 weeks. At the end of that 12 weeks, the meditation practitioners versus a control all had their genetic expression increased. So better inflammatory response, better lipid metabolism, all of their biochemical markers had changed for the better through this. Now, some smart graduate student at Harvard said, well, if 12 weeks does it, I wonder what one session does, right? So he took a number of individuals that were longtime meditators and another group of individuals who were just doing, said, just relax. And we're going to look at your biomarkers before and after 15 minutes of meditation. What he found is that in one session, 15 minutes, all their biomarkers were elevated into a more positive direction. 15 minutes, one meditation. Now, it doesn't mean that you can meditate once and everything is okay, but it does mean that it happens very rapidly. As I said, this happens in minutes and days, not in years. This is minutes and days of how we influence our epigenetics. So that can happen, and I thought it was interesting. Okay, what day is it, asked Pooh. It's today, squeaked Piglet. My favorite day, said Pooh. So it's that present time awareness that comes from the meditation practice. Okay, I think this is one of the last few slides. Transgenerational epigenetics, what is that? It means that genes can skip a generation. And why this occurs, the mechanism of how this occurs is really unknown. But where this was first discovered was with the survivors of concentration camps. The prediction was that the children of survivors would have a hyperarousal for stress because of what their parents had been through. Turns out that was not the case. However, the grandchildren of the survivors did have a hyperarousal response. This is a more recent study which looked at obesity. They looked at grandmothers and grandfathers and said, did their tendency to be obese be reflected in their children being obese or not? The answer was no. Then they looked at the third generation, the grandchildren. They looked at the patrilineal inheritance to the male child. The answer was no. It did not predict obesity. However, for the matrilineal line, so grandmother, daughter did not have a weight problem, grandchild had a tendency to obesity. Now, why that occurs, no one knows, but there's a whole subset of research going on looking at transgenerational epigenetics. So this is, we learned about genetics today, Dad. I inherited your eye and hair color. I also inherited your memories of Wild Susie in the summer of 68. There is research that we do inherit memories of long-term memories. So watch out what you pass on. Okay, let's get that. Okay, it says, remember the 20 extra years you added to your life through clean, healthy living? Well, these are them. So I trust that's not going to be the case. In fact, I assure you it won't be. Okay, now this is the last study, and then I'll get to one concluding slide. To me, this is the most interesting study of everything that I found in the literature. This is from NASA. And NASA keeps epigenetic assays on all of their astronauts they have for more than 20 years. They're intensely interested in genetics and epigenetic expression because of the abnormal condition of zero gravity and life in the International Space Station. So in 2018, Scott Kelly set a record. He was the longest, had been in space for 1 year, basically the longest astronaut in space history. He has an identical brother named Mark, who's also an astronaut. And Mark Kelly is married to Gabby Giffords. You know, she was the woman from the U.S. House of Representatives who was shot. So they had epigenetic profiles on both twin brothers. One had been in space for a year, the other had not. When Scott returned, what they found is that 7% of his epigenetic expression had changed. Now, I don't know if that sounds like a little or a lot, but consider the baseline that the epigenetic expression difference between us and chimpanzees is about 1% to 2%. So 7% change is huge. It's an immense change. And I just read an article a couple of weeks ago that they now have followed up with Scott Kelly. And what they found is that 4%, 3% has gone back pretty much to normal. 4% has remained unchanged, but they have no idea what that means. 4% of what? 4% is going to make him a genius? It's going to make him prone to some dreaded weird disease? We have no idea what that means. That's why this whole CRISPR editing technology is so dangerous. We have no idea what the result of that is. We have no idea. And NASA is concerned about this because if this occurs in 1 year, what happens on long duration space flight? So you take 2 years to get to Mars. Does the next generation born to those pioneers who land on Mars with a changed epigenetic profile, is that then a human being? Is that a totally different species because their genes have changed so much in 2 years in the conditions of space travel? We don't know. But these are kind of, to me, this is fascinating where you take very high tech and this very kind of biological approach. Something like this. Oh, master, is it proper for a monk to use email? Yes, as long as there are no attachments. I love it. Okay. Let me back up if I can. These are two important. I'm a little bit over time. I apologize. It's okay. Are we all right? I'll be finished in about 5 minutes. Hang in there. This is looking over the horizon. These are things that are coming. We've been looking at what is. We're looking at what's coming. So this is a nanotechnology. Nanotechnology is the technology of the super small. So nanotech, this is a computer that is the size of a head of a pin. You swallow it. And in the transit time through your body, which ranges from 24 to 72 hours, it transponds 25 or 30 biological signals. Heart rate, frequency, blood pressure, hormone levels, stress hormones, etc. And you have a patch, well, it's on the side, but it could be on your arm, transponds it to your cell phone, and you can see precisely what is taking place in your body after you eat something, do something, meditate, whatever, based on this technology. This, again, it exists. It will probably, it's in some pharmacology now, and I think it's going to become very pervasive and available over the counter in the not too distant future. So this is a study. If you look at the upper graph, it's where we looked at the use of metformin and its impact on blood sugar. And you can see with regular dosing, it has a regular impact on blood sugar. You look in the lower right, here's someone that's not taking their medication appropriately and their blood sugar is all over the place. Now it can take months to regulate medication dosages and dietary changes with a diabetic. Here you can do this in a matter of days. You know exactly what's taking place with their medication and their pharmacology. This is a real breakthrough. This next one is one of the negatives or pushbacks with the epigenetic assay is a blood draw, right? How many of you here like blood draws? Good. I've never had anyone say, actually I had one woman say yes. I had a talk with her afterwards. Everybody hates blood draws, right? So this is a blood draw technology, which is now available. It's in FDA, final stages of FDA approval. What it is, it's about half the size of a tennis ball. You put it on your upper arm. In 45 seconds in a vacuum, it draws blood through your pores into this device. It's room temperature stable. It'll stable for up to 30 days. It's not even considered to be a biohazard. You can drop it in the mail and send it to a lab directly. It's not a biohazard. Stay stable for 30 days. So suddenly the idea of getting an accurate blood chemistry as part of your profile is entirely doable. Again, this exists, it's in use, it's in limited use, what they call, you basically have a phlebotomist overseeing these blood draws. And then at some point, this will be granted an autonomous license. And again, year or two from now, it'll be an over-the-counter. The company is called, it'll come to me, forgive me. I'll try to remember, but thank you. I forgot the name of the company that's producing it. So this is the epigenetic assay providers that I told you about. So here are five different providers. All of them use state-of-the-art technology. They cost roughly $200 max for the assay. Arival, actually, unfortunately, has just gone out of business. They've just closed it down. But I think it'll come back, but it was one of the best. Then day two, and again, if you use Dr. Pelletier 30 on day two, you get this 30% discount. Habit was a company that actually was started by Campbell Soup. It was funded for $60 million because Campbell Soup wanted to produce genetically predetermined meals. So they wanted to know your profile and exactly what kinds of foods were best for you, and they were going to do a home delivery service with those foods. It's still going. Longevity has basically the genetic, blood, and microbiome in one package. It's a little bit more expensive. I'm not 100% certain I believe the microbiome assay that they have, but at least they've made an attempt to do that. And then, of course, 23andMe. I put that in there because everybody's heard of it. I personally do not advocate that particular system. Okay, so a new you, free makeover. First, we'll need a sample of your DNA. So we can go to extremes with these things. Okay, this is the last PowerPoint. So this is a summary of kind of what we've been talking about, that we're working on a tripartite assay, genetic, blood, and microbiome with a genetic counselor. Secondly, genetics or genes predict probabilities, not certainties. It's critical to remember that. Whatever assay you get back is a probability. It's a statistic. It's not you. And until you work with a genetic counselor and really drill down and find out, you know, for instance, spikes in blood chemistry and glycemic index, one of the best ways to blunt that is eat walnuts. Walnuts seem to modify and diminish that kind of glycemic spike. So that's something you'd learn with a genetic counselor. So that's important. Biomarkers of health, not disease. So I'm not interested in disease prediction. I'm interested in biomarkers of health so you optimize your health, you optimize your life expectancy. The monogenic or fully penetrant one-to-one, one gene equals one disease, or one complex of disease equals one disease is very limited. Genes work within complex genetic and environmental matrices. It's not a single gene doing something like a switch. It's in a complex of other genes and in a complex environment. This is a very complicated system. Someone likened to putting a stethoscope to the side of a computer. What would that really tell you? The human genome base is 21,000, actually probably 23,000 genes. 5% of the entire gene is known. The rest is what they call the dark genome. We don't know what it does. I think that's fascinating. Genes are turned on or off like a rheostat. They're expressed or suppressed, bright, dim. So there are certain ones you want to turn up. You'd like to turn up your intelligence, kind of turn down your inflammation. So that's how you regulate these functions. Gene expression changes what we do matters. Unequivocally, every single thing we do every day, diet, stress, environment, pharmacology, thought, meditation, stress, is affecting gene expression. Majority of genes are governed by beliefs and lifestyle choices. And lastly, the Neanderthal genes are alive and well. I mentioned that 5-7% of our genetic code is Neanderthal. And you think about what triggers violence, what triggers aggression, what triggers hostility, all the things that almost make us, you know, be apologetic for our species in terms of cruelty, that may be the genetic expression of Neanderthal genes. And what can we learn and what can we do about that to blunt that, to change it, I think is a critical question. So if you're depressed, you're living in the past. If you're anxious, you're living in the future. If you're at peace, you're living in the present. That's the book. And that's all, folks.
Thank you. So we've been listening to a presentation by Professor Kenneth Pelletier on epigenetics. And now, even though it's a bit of a late hour, we have time for questions. Who would like to ask the first question?
You mentioned loss of smell.
And yes.
What happens if someone is born with no sense of smell at all?
Yeah, anosia. The question was, I mentioned about that one of the early signs of early dementia, Alzheimer's, is a loss of a sense of smell. Now, if a person never had a sense of smell, then that does not apply because there's some kind of genetic limitation to that as a biomarker. The other is some people have head trauma, and as a result of head trauma, their ability to smell is reduced. So it's not 100%, but it's something that individuals I know that work in geriatrics tell me that they ask that question of a patient. Have you noticed any change in your sense of smell? And if they have, it's a kind of a check mark. This is now a concern to then seek out, is this early dementia in onset? Okay, does that help?
Yes.
Okay. It's not a perfect, one of those little checks that happens in a chart. Yes, sir.
What kind of effect does something like broad spectrum antibiotics have to do
with the biome? Right. The question was broad spectrum antibiotics. Broad spectrum antibiotics totally disrupt the intestinal tract completely. They will eliminate, there are good bacteria, there are neutral bacteria, and there are benign bacteria. Broad-spectrum antibiotics wipe everything out. It's like wiping the slate clean. So what you've done is you may eliminate a particular bacteria causing an infection that you do want to have wiped out. The problem is all of your good bacteria are destroyed in the process. So if you have to take antibiotics, which I would use with great caution, antibiotics are prescribed excessively. And we know that we're developing as a country, as a culture, as a people, antibiotic resistance, and it's very serious. Antibiotics are only good if you have a bacterial infection. So colds and flus, which are viral based, antibiotic does nothing, quite literally nothing, other than disrupt the intestinal tract. So avoid that at all costs for yourself or your children or your family. But if you do take antibiotics, the best thing to do is afterwards is to take probiotics, which are like E. coli would be a probiotic that you can select, or prebiotics. So foods that feed the body chemistry. So you want to basically repopulate the good bacteria in your intestinal tract with prebiotics, so the good foods that are in a Mediterranean diet, and also the use of probiotics to increase the count of the good bacteria. So that's a good way to basically weigh in, overcome the deficiency of what a broad-spectrum antibiotic creates. Does that help?
Okay. Right here.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah, no worries. So I really liked when you talked about your longevity piece. So I'm a pretty young dude.
You don't have any worries yet.
Yeah, I'm hoping to live for, a fairly long time. And a lot of the things that you mentioned, don't eat red meat, switch to, some fish. I think I'd love to do that. I love salmon. That sounds great. But one thing I'm interested in is, with technology kind of ramping up every year really, really quickly, and especially with social media and things like that, with cell phones, you mentioned how important human contact was, whether it be family or, your wife, your husband, whatever it might be. So in your opinion, I'm in a world right now where a lot of people my age and younger can't even hold the conversation, right? Because they're so used to, Snapchatting someone or whatever. So I'd love to hear your opinion on that and how I, a young dude society right now, can combat that and live to be, 120.
Okay, this is the young dude gene. response. So, you know, this is a question that has come up a number of times, and I'm kind of fascinated that this does come up as a question. There are a number of studies done now that look at the amount of anxiety, depression, increasing suicide rates among individuals, the millennial generation that are online. So you're connected, but you're not face-to-face. You're not in interaction. You stated the problem very clearly. You can't carry, or your friends can't carry on a conversation. There's kind of a social ineptitude that takes place. And so there's a very negative impact to that kind of unique isolation. It's pseudo-intimacy. You've got an email and maybe a picture and maybe interaction, but is there any real intimacy? Is there any real support or a comfort that goes on with that? The answer to that question is probably no. So companies, it's interesting now, companies that have a lot of distant employees, so banking, telecommunications, airline industry, travel business, that have a lot of remote employees are actually deliberately bringing people together. So it may be a monthly meeting where people actually meet and you get to know each other. So if I know you, and then we're writing back and forth, that's very different because I can get on the phone, I can call you or meet somewhere or do something that's not necessarily online. But it's, when it's purely online, I think it's kind of deteriorative and it's not in keeping with anything that these extreme cultures, they don't know what a cell phone is. I mean, literally, you go into these villages and there's no cell phone service for one thing, which is great. You know, I'm a sailor, so I'm on the ocean a lot. And you know, you're in areas where there's just huge blank zones. There's no phone reception. It is heaven. So you know, I think the best thing is to deliberately create the social interactions with yourself, with your friends, with your family. And that will extend your life expectancy. There's no doubt about that. Young dude. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. You talked about the microbiome a lot.
Yes.
I'm curious what your take on like various techniques like help reset that, such as intermittent fasting or like various serums and, you know, drinks that you can make with certain like cayenne pepper and stuff like that, like what your take is on how that affects the microbiome.
Okay. Sure. That's a complicated question, but everything affects the microbiome, literally everything. And I do believe that periodic fasting is good. And so periodic fasting can be fasting once a month for 3 days. It can be 24-hour fast once a week. But the ability to stop the digestive and ingestion of food process in your body and allow it to self-regulate. Our body is incredible when given the opportunity to self-regulate toward health. It's remarkable what it does. So the periodic fasting gives the body a chance to restore its baseline. So that, I think, is absolutely, I'm trying to think, there's a researcher at UCLA who's just written a great book on periodic fasting. Longo, yeah, Longo, L-O-N-G-O. Yeah, is a book by Longo from UCLA on periodic fasting. He basically is the person that's really done the science behind this. It's really excellent. As far as foods, what you find, for instance, in the long-lived cultures is that spicy foods are very common. And I think there's a reason for that. So their taste buds change, their olfactory sensation changes as they age into 90 and 100. And so spices, hot, spicy things, you can taste it, you know, right? There's a lot of things you can't taste anymore, seriously. And so the hot, spicy stuff are things you can taste. And you find that the use of hot, spicy herbs is common among these cultures. So there's something benign about cayenne and turmeric and red peppers and those kinds of things that are characteristic of all of these cultures. As far as some of the commercial probiotic and prebiotic drinks, that's really questionable. Some of them, I don't know them all. There are probably hundreds of these kinds of things. Some of them are probably very good. Others are just kind of silly because most of what you consume is broken down in digestion. So even when you consume a high probiotic with tens of millions of cells and bacteria, you're probably only going to end up with a few hundred or a few thousand because it has to pass through digestion. So the better thing to do is rely on diet. So prebiotic foods like the Mediterranean diet, that fosters the healthy growth in the intestines. Does that help? Yes, yes, yeah, right. And the Greg, is his first name Greg Longo?
I think it means
Friday. Well, Dr. Longo's book, I'll hedge my bets. Dr. Longo's book does talk about actually going into the post-fasting interval with the prebiotic foods. So yes, that's definitely a good thing to do. And it does prolong your life expectancy. Yes.
Are you familiar with this doctor and his work, Dr. Boyce, and regarding sensitive children?
No, I don't know that book.
Okay. How they grow up in terms of some kids, same kids in one family, grow up very differently. And he talks a lot about like mental illness, how it comes about, and epigenetics is part of his...
Oh.
So I thought maybe you knew a little bit to expand on mental illness in terms of epigenetics.
I don't, and I'm not as familiar about the epigenetics of, say, psychological disorders or psychiatric illness. There was a book I wrote many years ago called Sound Mind, Sound Body. And I interviewed individuals who were remarkably healthy, and I looked at them developmentally over time. And so they included Norman Cousins at the time, Steve Jobs, George Lucas, Lawrence Rockefeller, David Rockefeller. It was an incredible group of people. And what I found, much to my surprise, is that every single one of them, everyone without exception, had some horribly traumatic event as a child. And because of that and rallying around that horribly traumatic event has made them the person that they became. And they would always refer back to that. So Norman Cousins was confined to a tuberculosis sanitarium. Paul Hawken, Smith and Hawken, his both parents were killed tragically when he was very young. So all of them had these major traumas that they had to kind of overcome and then move forward. Now, it doesn't mean you have to have a trauma to be a healthy, functional adult, but it means it doesn't have to impede you. Totally agree with that. So the observation was there's no correlation between trauma predetermining a negative versus a positive outcome, and I would totally agree with that. And that's, again, how you adapt to that genetic push. Are you going to overcome it, or are you going to succumb? So that, yeah, thank you. I will check that book out.
Regarding fasting... Did Longo write a book or a paper? How do I get to
Oh, it's
read
a book.
It?
It's L-O-N-G-O. Longo is his last name, and I've forgotten the name of the book, quite honestly. But you have it?
The Longevity Diet, Walter Longo.
What is his name?
The Longevity Diet.
Uh-huh.
Is the book, and it's Walter Longo.
Okay, The Longevity Diet. Longevity Diet, and it's by Longo, L-O-N-G-O. It's a terrific book. It's an easy read. He's done a lot of the basic biochemical research, and yet he's a very good author. So I think that's a good one. I like that. I like his work a lot.
Okay, time for two more questions.
I'll combine two quick ones. Regarding the blue zone, which I find fascinating, because so all those factors were interesting. Was there any kind of exploration into what might be causative and what was correlation? And also, what did they finally die of?
Yeah, that's a good question. It can be thought of as correlational. You know, really, if you think about it, it's really not, you can't say definitively it's causative, except for the fact that all of these individuals have these variables in common. And the product, if you will, it's like looking at a multivariate analysis. You don't know which factor produced the outcome, but you have a demonstrable outcome over time in multiple cultures with the same characteristics. So the presumption is that they are causative as opposed to correlational. What they die of, it's usually organ failure. And just a complete, utter, total, things wear out. Liver gives out, kidney disease, heart disease. Most of them, they don't have heart attacks. You don't find them keeling over in the fields. But it's literally like just every, we call it global organ failure. here in the U.S. if that happens to a person. And that's pretty much the cause of death with these individuals. They don't have autopsies on them, so it's hard to really know. But that's what I suspect is occurring with them. Yeah.
Your last question?
It's very peaceful, by the way. I've had people, you know, when these individuals die, they say, you know, if you've been with patients who die, a person can live a wonderful life and be a wonderful person, and that last 5 minutes can get pretty ugly. It can be very, quite devastating. And I've had individuals who have been with these long-lived people when they die, and they all say it's quiet, it's peaceful. The transition is almost imperceptible.
It's a good day to die.
Good day to die.
Like Little Big Man.
Yep. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Hello. Given all the medical research that we have today, and we're all better informed, or most of us are better informed, we have access to much more information.
Yes.
Are there specific trends that show changes are going, things are getting worse in some diseases and some are getting better as we're better informed, we eat better, we exercise better? And does it vary in the, say, take the North America geographically, if there are certain areas that have benefited from it more than others?
That's a very good question. The question was about, given all the information, advancements in medical technology, are there cultures and countries that seem to be better versus ones that are worse? Well, the one thing I can tell you for certain is that the United States is one of the worst. If you look at World Health Organization statistics for the United States versus all the other post-industrial nations against which we measure our economic output, our global competition, gross domestic product, the United States ranks 37th in life expectancy, in health categories like the amount of heart disease, the amount of cancer, the amount of suicide, the amount of fatal accidents. The other country that ranks 37th is Bosnia. So when all is said and done, for all of we spend the most amount of money per capita. It's about $12,000 to $15,000 per year in 2019. That's twice the amount of the next closest nation, which is Germany. Spends about $5,000 to $6,000 per year, and Germany is up around 7th or 8th in those global figures. The United States is 37th. So the point is that our approach to health is just not an approach to health. We do a great job with disease. We have great surgeries, great trauma centers, et cetera. We do an absolutely terrible job of promoting, sustaining health, as opposed to every other nation on earth, the other 36 that do a better job. Now, if you look at the three or four nations that are at the top, they're usually Scandinavian countries. So Norway, Sweden, Finland, all of them have longer life expectancies. And if you look at their medical care system, it's really excellent, but it's not excessive. So here, if you come in with tennis elbow, you're likely to get an MRI. Really? you know, here in San Francisco, we have more MRIs in San Francisco than all of Canada. So these, again, I could go on and on, but, you know, you could, these statistics just point out the fact that we have an excellent disease management system. We have a very poor healthcare system. And my advocacy for as long as I've been around has been to advocate the fact that what we need is healthcare and keeping with the blue zones and keeping with these epigenetic determinants with an emphasis on health. I don't know if that's hard to answer your question, but I hope that's a start. Okay? All right, good. All right, thank you.
So I'm Bill Grant, co-chair of the Health and Medicine member of that forum of the Commonwealth Club. We thank Professor Kenneth Pelletier for his talk on epigenetics this evening. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating 116, I believe, years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.
Wonderful presentation.
Thank you. That was great. That was very enjoyable.